From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. Now, we cover a lot of local stories here at WHQR, but admittedly, we don't spend as much time on the business world, especially not with the kind of inside baseball granularity that an outlet like the Wilmington Business Journal does. We do keep an eye on business and the economy, but we tend to prioritize stories based on how they'll impact the broader community, including vulnerable and marginalized people, more than what's going on in the business world for its own sake. We've also covered issues where businesses got public money as part of an economic incentive, because we feel like that's part of holding local government accountable. All that said, there are plenty of interesting things going on in Wilmington's business world, particularly when it comes to the culture of tech and startup entrepreneurs here. There's a lot happening that many people, including me, aren't paying a ton of attention to. But I do get emails about this now and then, asking some good questions that I don't really have answers to. Like, what does it mean for a company or an industry to have a culture? How does that culture evolve in a particular place, like Wilmington? What makes our local scene different than the big tech firms, Google, Meta, Amazon, that lay people like me are more familiar with? And I do have some questions of my own. For example, hearing about these legendary 90-hour weeks, I wonder how entrepreneurs and their teams keep from just crashing and burning. I also wonder about what successful companies owe to the public. Legally, of course, they're free to just make a profit and relish their success. But I often hear entrepreneurs talk about giving back. So what does that look like? So when Jim Roberts asked if I would be interested in sitting down to host a roundtable with some local tech entrepreneurs, I said yes. Why not spend some time and fill in the blind spot, at least a little bit? I've known Jim since I worked at Port City Daily, although my beats haven't often intersected with his work. He's founded and worked with a number of organizations that support startups, including Wilmington Angels for Local Entrepreneurs, or WALE, and Network for Entrepreneurs in Wilmington, or NEW, groups that you'll hear mentioned at least a few times on today's show. Jim also helped me wrangle up 4 entrepreneurs, all part of the Wilmington startup scene, but each with their own perspective. Jessica Kovar, Rob Cooley, Christian Pardue, and Morris Wynn. You can find out more about each of them and Jim in the show notes for this episode at whqr.org. Okay, we'll kick things off now with each of our guests introducing themselves and their business and saying a little bit about tech and startup culture.
So I'm Jessica Kovar. I have a company called It's a Go Pursuits. And I work with small businesses, large businesses to pursue federal work. So what that means is really just from the get-go looking for opportunities and then helping them pursue those opportunities through positioning and then chasing the actual pursuit to win that big federal work. So what tech culture means to me is a little bit difficult because I am in an office by myself, home office. But I do have employees that work from remote locations, and so we rely so heavily on the technology, just in a different way. But what we were talking about earlier, just with like it comparing to Google, there's really no comparison for us, but just that's how we work together. That's how we work with all of our clients. All of our clients are national, so that's where the technology is super important to us. On the other side of that is that I'm working on software, very, very beginning stages, which again is difficult for me to talk about because when it comes to the tech side, that's just not my background. I can do federal proposals day in and day out, but you know, the technology, building a software is really difficult. So I'm learning from the ground up what that actually means and what it looks like.
I'm sure that is an adventure.
It is. Yeah, it's humbling.
Yeah. Hey, Rob Cooley. I'm the co-founder and CEO of a company called Nurim. We're a neurodata science company enabled by really transformative advanced neurosensing materials. So we're going to combine hardware, software, and data to use brainwaves to fundamentally change and improve outcomes for the lives of many. I also own Appalani's Bake Shop here in town and a co-owner in the Wine Sampler. So talk about serial entrepreneurship, that's kind of fun to blend those because I learned things from each of those businesses, which are really, really exciting. If you talk about culture by itself, right? There's statements in the public space that say culture eats strategy all day long. And so whether you're big or small, how you define, and it really starts with the co-founders and the owners of the business, the culture that they set within their organization really puts the team on a pathway for success or not success. So we use our culture in Nareem and all our other businesses as a lens to look at potential companies to partner with, potential hires. We use that culture piece as our superhero kind of go-to-market, and we use it as a means to separate us from folks that are in a tech space. So culture is unique by itself. And then you add the component of tech on it. And tech's supposed to be innovative and creative and move quickly. But at some point, you outgrow that, and then you're stale. And that's not what tech folks want to be. And so some folks get too big to fail or too big to have their culture anymore. And that's where you see people start to move. But culture is really, really important in everything that we do. Certainly in the military that we did, and in every one of the small businesses for sure.
Hi, yeah, my name's Christian Pardue, and I moved here from Raleigh about 3 years ago after my company I built there in Raleigh, Shift Wizard, was acquired. I was fortunate enough to get acquired right before COVID actually took a grasp on the country. Since I moved to Wilmington, I've started another startup, teamed up for dentistry. I've also gotten involved in an angel group here called Whale, and I've plugged in pretty tightly with New, the ecosystem here for entrepreneurs, because my goal is just to give back, to help teach, and to help new entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs in general just maybe avoid some of the mistakes that I made. For me, culture has always been a strong focus, because having built my business Shift Wizard in Raleigh, you know, you have companies like SAS and all the big companies, and their culture is always amazing. And being a startup, it's very intimidating, and it's also very difficult to recruit good talent to a startup company, because you can't offer all of those things that those companies are offering. So as a startup, it's always been a challenge for me. And all of my companies, I usually exit, you know, right around 5 million ARR. So I'm always really in startup mode for the most part, always focused on culture. And so we spend a lot of time, my team, figuring out, okay, what is it that we can do to attract good talent from those bigger companies to come over and work for us? And it's not always a number. It's not always a benefit. You know, a lot of talented developers and various other members of a tech team, you know, they love the startup environment. They love the challenge, the scrappiness, of being able to build something from scratch and be part of that journey. So, culture is always something you have to focus on as a startup, because you do have to compete with those bigger companies and pull some good talent over to your smaller company.
So I'm Morris Nguyen, the founder and CEO of Predicate. And with Predicate, we are harnessing the power of AI to kind of find the silent killers behind patient-reported symptoms. And the question about tech culture, for me, I think tech culture goes beyond just, you know, a logoed shirt and jeans in a blazer. So I think it depends on who you ask and where they're located in the country. I think there's different pockets of tech culture. And I think it's also an evolving definition of culture as well. But I think fundamentally it's the DNA or the blueprint of how technology and society in that particular geography kind of commingle together. One of the things that is important, I think, with tech culture is the idea of transparency. So we know that in the era of AI, there's increased scrutiny over bias and data privacy and accountability. So transparency has to be a cornerstone of trust. And I think that's something that every conversation about tech culture should include, especially now.
So a lot of you touched on this in different ways. There is something about, especially, you know, in startup mode, but from people who work in tech, where there's this energy and sometimes it's frantic, but it is different than, say, like a Fortune 500 company where, you know, they're looking for slow, steady growth. You know, I feel like on the one hand, that's incredibly exciting. On the other hand, there's like some risk of burnout. I've certainly heard of some startups where, you know, 80 hours a week just won't get it done. How do you look at that balance of, you know, being excited, engaged, but not burning the candle at both ends in the middle?
So I'm still on that learning curve of how to balance it. I've gotten into the situation even recently where I am working those hours. I take on a lot. The work is difficult, and the work in and of itself and proposal federal, it leads to burnout generally. And so just really recognizing it before I hit that wall that I have hit burnout or close to burnout, and just taking the time that I need for myself. I do have the luxury of working with really large businesses and then also small businesses. So I get to see a lot of, just from the technology standpoint, how these large businesses are doing things, and then take that to my small clients, plus for myself, how they're managing their time, their workload, you know, all of the things that help with the work-life balance, if there is such a thing.
I don't know if there is that. I'm a journalist. I don't know if that's I'm a bad person to ask about that.
I think it's really interesting. When you say the word balance, so many people can define that differently, and there is no work-life balance. As the entrepreneur, it's all work, all life at the same time. And so there is a DNA component to people that say they want to be an entrepreneur and do these startup things. Not everybody is built or designed for it. Some folks love the consistency of Fortune 500, stable. I show up at my desk, hear my hours, and I clock in, I clock out, which is fine. It's absolutely needed. But there's a couple of folks that is troubling to them, and their creative juices are unable to be brought to bear. And so the startup world is something that is of interest, but it's either all on or all off. And you'd go through that cycle 100 times a day. And so one minute you're patting yourself on the back as the greatest, the goat out there in this technology space. The next thing you're like, oh my goodness, we're done, we're doomed. And then 2 minutes later kind of continues to go. So if you don't have that internal makeup to be able to absorb a lot of no's to get to perhaps a yes, this may not be the right space for it. But once you're in the space, like Chris said, is the ecosystem of partners within this particular area. There's folks like Jim Roberts doing his stuff. Joe Colopy's coming down with GrubBeat. There's an ecosystem that allows entrepreneurs, both new and seasoned, to trust each other, transparency that Morris was talking about, to build a level of trust among each other so we can bounce ideas off of each other, because you can't do it all by yourself. If you try to micromanage or do it all, especially as an entrepreneur, you will hit burnout immediately because you just can't do it. And then how do you, within that model of balance, look to find the right partners, whether it's internally, externally, paid by the drink, consultants, all the way trying to manage this thing called a budget and a P&L, and maybe this thing called a balance sheet as well. But that's how this is very, very unique and dynamic. You got to find the right line, and some days you're 100%, 110% all go, and the other days you've got to figure out where to kind of take a step back. Because one thing that entrepreneurs don't do is they don't have enough time to think, right? They don't allow themselves the creative space in the day that said, okay, right, I got 100 things going on, they're all hair on fire, but let me just step back because I'm too close to the fire. Let me step back and think about what we're doing. And if you don't build that into your daily, weekly, monthly routine, and you got to force it, right? We're all overbooked, but you got to force time, beginning of the day, middle of the day, end of day, to just stop, think, turn off the devices, and let your brain just kind of wander. Let it wander, let it go, have a little notepad or something else to take notes, because you'll find most of your creative solutions are found in that kind of quiet space.
Yeah. And for me, again, kind of reflecting back to a startup environment, it's really, especially at the level I'm at, when oftentimes you don't even have an MVP product yet built. It's the Wild Wild West. It really is. I used to have a quote on my office door back in my Shift Wizard days that said, be the kind of company that when your competition wakes up in the morning, they're saying, shit, they already got out of bed, right? But the burnout factor is something really to focus on, because also as a startup, quite often you only have one person or two people at most working on those timelines and getting those goals done. You got to really take time as a founder and as a leader to make sure that those people aren't burning themselves out, because they will waste themselves. They will, your folks who are committed to you and in that startup environment, they will absolutely burn themselves out. It's almost like you have to go to them and force them to take a day off or take time off. So, you know, we would initiate things like work from home Fridays and unlimited vacation days and things like that from a startup. That's some of the things that we could bring to the table that would help us compete with some of the bigger things that the bigger companies were doing. As a founder myself, as Rob mentioned, you know, regrounding myself by plugging into the ecosystem, because as a co-founder, you're constantly moving. Going to the new meetings as a founder, it really recenters me. allows me to focus more on what's going on in my environment. And I also get great feedback from the folks that are on the stage because it's like a Me Too sort of thing. And it forces me to go, have I thought about that lately? And do I need to figure out what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong, and do I need to adjust? So going to those types of meetings, plugging into that ecosystem, really gives me a chance to stop thinking about what I think about every day and think about the big picture.
Yeah, there's a reason why, at least in my vertical with health tech, there's a reason why only 2 out of 10 startups make it. You know, most fail. I mean, it's not for the faint of heart. I go through what I call the founder's paradox, which is going from fist pump to fetal position in a daily basis. You repeat it over and over and over again. I think one of the biggest lessons learned as a founder is, because I've been on the other side with Fortune 500, and there's no template to be a founder. No matter what you've heard or what you think you know, it's all going to be deconstructed once you become a founder, and it happens over and over again. But you know, managing expectations and being able to be resilient and tenacious enough to withstand those market changing conditions, that has to be crucial. The other thing that I agree with everything said before is the power of the ecosystem. Guys like Jim, obviously here is a big part of it. And in ecosystems that foster collaboration over competition, that is what really, really drives the success of many startups here.
So I'm glad a couple of you have brought this ecosystem issue up, and I want to dig a little bit deeper into this, because I think lay people, I think, often are imagining right now the tech world through the narrative of like people spinning off from Google and starting some generative AI company and getting reabsorbed into Google, and it's very and it looks very easy from the outside. And I, you know, that doesn't jive with, you know, 8 of 10 startups dying. So I'm curious if you can get a little bit more into, you know, outside of that stratosphere, like what is it like to actually build a company and like go from back of a napkin maybe one day to a real thing that really exists and is really getting federal grants, or, you know, piloting, you know, actual projects, or delivering a company, you know, to a stable platform.
Do I have to go first? On
you don't
one?
Have to go first. Let's reverse the order more. So let's go
okay.
with you first.
So sorry, can you summarize? There's a lot to it.
There's a lot to that, but like, you know, what is it like to go from, okay, on Monday I have a great idea,
yeah,
and I would like to build a company, and there is no billion-dollar company swooping in to just say, hey, Morris, that was a great idea. We're going to create a company for you. You have to do it. What does that look like?
Well, one, I think it's important. You have to be obsessed with the problem you're solving. Absolutely obsessed with it. And that's one thing that I am. Every single day I wake up is, you know, it's like the problem I'm like why I started the company. And it's every single day. It's being obsessed with solving that problem. So, and recognizing that, you know, version A through X may not work, but Y may, and just being able to do that. And it's also, it's being nimble enough to make mistakes, because it depends on kind of what industry you're in. We're in healthcare. We don't get a lot of latitude for mistakes. So it's putting in the resources and the time to maybe you may delay time to market, and investors don't like to hear that, but we're doing it right. Like we're building an ethical or a trustworthy AI model now rather than trying to fix the mistakes afterwards. So that's something you have to work with.
Yeah, I agree with everything he said, and it kind of goes back to the quote that he just mentioned, or not the quote, but a quote he just said was, you know, you go from pounding your chest to fetal position a few times a day. And that is so true. I think back at my last startup, Shift Wizard, and you know, it was about a 15-year project, and I built it about the hardest way you could build it, and that was I didn't plug into an ecosystem at all, because I didn't know the ecosystems existed. So for 15 years, it was just me, and my team, of course, but I did not give them the benefits of plugging into that. Those type of resources for me personally, as well as for the team in general. And to be successful, you just know going into it that every single time that you're elated and happy, realize that there's going to be a stomach punch right around the corner that's going to drop you about as low as you can go. And then you just have to, in that time, realize it's going to get better. And tomorrow or next week, you're going to be elated again. And you're going to have no's, and you're going to have disappointments and challenges, and things aren't going to work. And everything could possibly go wrong is going to go wrong. And then everything that possibly has to go right is going to go right. It's just not, it's not for the faint of heart at all, but just for those people that are just persistent and they just know that they're going to get through the tribulations they're going to go through in order to be successful.
Yeah, I think Morse's point about defining your problem statement. So if you had 1 hour to figure out how to start a company, spend 59 minutes on the problem, define that, and then a minute trying to figure out how you're going to fix it. Because unfortunately, a lot of either seasoned entrepreneurs or new entrepreneurs have a great idea or a widget, but it's not solving a problem that somebody's going to pay for that you can make a profit on. So if you don't get through the problem statement and define it very, very well, then you can spend hours and hours and tons of investor money, but you're developing a widget that nobody really needs or a solution that's unmanageable. So focus on the problem. Now, these ecosystems, right, allow you to test that, right, throw it against the wall for folks who've been in different environments, academia, business, startup, banking, finance, to see if it actually has some tackiness or not. Right. The worst thing to do is tell an entrepreneur your little baby is ugly and we're going to throw it out with the bathwater. But that needs to happen early. So the flip side of that is once you understand the problem that you're trying to solve, understand how to fail fast, but fail well. So what that means is, right, in the startup world, you've got to try, test, evaluate, and move on to something else. If it doesn't, the word pivot is a little bit overused, but that's the idea. As long as you're focused on providing a solution to a problem that exists and people want to pay for, you're going to have to move a lot faster than you ever anticipated. It's going to take twice as long, twice as much money, but you've got to move, because if you look at all the big companies, they didn't start out the way they are today. Yeah. They started with a different model, a different solution they were kind of figuring, but they moved with a very smart team from pivot point A to B to C, and they continue to maximize their value proposition. So if you can't do two of those things, define the problem and then understand how to fail fast and fail well, you're going to be in this vicious downward spiral, and that's not a good spot for an entrepreneur or startup company.
I think you've tapped into something I hear a lot, and that's when tech writ large is the punching bag of jokes. It's people who are developing technology with no killer app, it is not solving a problem. It's, you know, how can I make Garfield with an Uzi and a bra? You know, like, it's great, but like, what problem was that? I didn't have that. That was not, you know, a day-to-day right. issue where I'm like, God, I wish there was a, you know, technological shortcut to this.
Yeah. And that was one thing that came up at one of Jim Roberts' meetings or events that he had one evening was someone had said that with AI, everyone was just trying to figure out how they could use AI. And they weren't really thinking, like, how do I solve this massive problem using AI? And at that point, I was like, I think I'm onto something, because I have a huge problem that needs assistance.
The federal contract process
yes,
is a nightmare.
Exactly. Yeah. It's perfectly said. Yeah. It's a nightmare.
My words, not yours.
Yeah. And so, you know, when I first got into this, I left my corporate job just because I saw such a big need. And so I started this thinking, okay, I just need to replace my income. Or at least get close to it. And as I started meeting with new clients and partners, I was realizing that there's a much bigger need than I even thought, and that's really helping small businesses compete with large businesses. So the difficult part for me right now, and maybe where that burnout's coming, it's great talking to you guys to know that you all been through it a lot, is that I'm doing the work to get the cash flow in for the software. And so there's that massive balance that needs to help there. But getting that software launched is a big priority for me.
That's another question I want to ask about, because I hear this from aspiring entrepreneurs, and it is this, and it's opaque to, again, to the layperson. Like, we don't really see this process, but we know in theory it must happen, is you go into an idea with a certain purity. It's you against the world. It's your idea against the problem. And then at a certain point, other people get involved, whether that's a board or investors or the public, or, you know, if you get like an economic development grant, then the public's sort of involved, being like, hey, what are you doing? What's our ROI on this? So have you guys been through that process where it was, you know, it was just you in a foxhole, and then all of a sudden it wasn't?
The answer is yeah, absolutely. So I'll go back to the culture, right, comment. So if you're looking to pick a strategic partner or grant money or a board of directors or a board of advisors, right? That cultural lens that you want inside of your company, you apply that to all your partnerships. You don't become blind, right? Put your blinders on, and it's the self-flicking lollipop where everybody looks just like you, sounds like you, and thinks like you. That's not what you want. What you want is the diversity of thought, the equality of thinking from different perspectives. And inclusion includes, right, that's a double include. It really should be one that is allowing the thought diversity to come inside, and then you make a good decision, right? These are not democracies. You know, these are run by boards or startup founders, and navigating that process is very, very important. And so that's where, right, we differentiate ourselves based on the culture of our companies. And if we deviate from that, you're confusing your board, you're confusing your advisors, you're confusing your employees. So that's why defining that as part of your problem statement is how you go to market. And you must stay consistent until you get to one of those kind of inflection points where you're acquired by somebody or something like that. That's a completely different model. But that's how important it is up front, is to really think through that judiciously and thoughtfully. Because if you make those mistakes up front, the trust factor that we were talking about is gone, right? Investors won't come to you. Partners won't come to you, because in this tech culture world, good news travels fast, bad news travels 10 times faster. And once you have that mark against you, it's a much harder hill to climb at that point, but you can do it right at the beginning. And again, that's where this ecosystem allows us to kind of throw ideas out and get an honest feedback. Hey, look, I've been doing SaaS or B2B for, you know, 3 decades, and I'm not sure you're there yet, but here's some ideas to think about it, go back. That's not a no. It's not a yes, but it's not a go away. It's come back and think about it. And that's where it's really, really important.
Yeah. And I think that's the difference between a very slow moving company and a company moving at the speed you want it to go. So as I mentioned earlier, I built my first business without any help from anybody whatsoever, only because I didn't realize it existed. And that company grew very, very slow. And you're right, by really early on, when you're at the product, when you're at the idea phase, you're sharing that with folks constantly, all the time. And they're the ones that are helping you realize, okay, but, you know, pothole up here, pothole up there, don't step there, don't back up here. But also, being part of the ecosystem, you're plugged into a very rich set of resources that can kind of help you build exactly what you need to build. So when you get to that point to where you're looking for VC capital, you've got all the pieces in place that they're looking for you to have. Or even at the angel level, like myself, you know, I look for very specific things that companies have. And that's one of the things I look for, is do they have that mid and long-term plan and not just focus on the next 30 days? Because it's very easy at that stage to be focused on nothing but what am I going to do next 30 days? But you really have to focus on what's coming down the road. And so, again, the difference between a very slow-moving company and one that's growing at the pace you would really want it to go.
Yeah, I think it's also kind of the kind of maturity as a founder. It used to be early days to be, you know what, whoever write me the first check, you're in. Come on in. I'll take it, whatever. You know, with your proverbial, you know, cardboard and cup standing, get whatever investor dollars you can. But the reality is, as I matured as a founder, I realized, well, they're not really aligning with my why. And that's so important to me, because it can make or break my company. And if they're not aligning with that vision, then that's a non-starter. So that's something that really I have to be careful now and to understand, going beyond the investment thesis and trying to kind of interview them and to understand who they are as investors is something we're starting to do as well. Also, we've kind of diversified, going beyond just the traditional pathways for investment and looking more like impact investors, because there is a social impact that we can make, and really kind of carving out that or creating that narrative on how we fit into that social impact. So it's just things like that help us you know, navigate. Just like this year, historically, it's been a tough fundraising year. So we've had to, it's forced us to kind of think differently.
I've got a couple different questions, but I do want to take a quick pit stop and note that, you know, you're all doing this in the Wilmington area, and presumably you're all intelligent people with good ideas. You could probably go other places. You know, I'm just curious, why Wilmington?
So I've only been here a couple of years. I think it's 3 years yesterday, exactly.
Congratulations.
And thank you. So I didn't necessarily choose Wilmington. We visited here, loved the city. We're like, we can make it go anywhere. And I had just started my business, and I knew I could move it wherever I wanted. But being here specifically, I will always go back to this. I met Jim at a UNCW CIE event, and I asked him if he would do breakfast with me. We met at Blueberries one morning, and you know, it was like one of those things where I was like, okay, he's listening and he's taking in all of this of what my needs are. And I thought, okay, once this meeting's over, I'll probably never see him again. But before I even got home, like, emails had gone out. He connected me to all of these people. And then I started going to the events, and all the people that he connected me to are also in the community. And it's just, it's really cool to be a smaller community, but yet large enough where it can, you know, you have a lot of outreach. But that really started, and like what you guys were saying, I didn't know that this existed anywhere. I knew there were incubators and, things through the community colleges, but I had no idea that there was such a, intricate ecosystem available to me. And the things that I have been able to do, the, resources that I've gotten, the things that I've gotten for free, just having this conversation with you all, they're the things that are taking my business to the next level that I would have never known it existed.
I mean, I'll tell you, Wilmington's not a bad place to hang your hat.
Right.
So let's just, we can say that pretty well.
I've moved here twice.
No, you want to talk about culture, environment. Yeah, this is not, it's okay. I've been in a lot of places that are not okay. This one is definitely okay. But it's interesting because, you know, everything that an ecosystem should have is here in Wilmington. It just may not be in the right positions yet. And so, right, Wilmington has been known as a fintech, right? Encino, Live Oak Bank, absolutely crushed it. Now all the spinoffs from them are just continuing that fintech kind of bubble out here, right? Some of us, well, three of us on this side are all, right, trying to put a little ink spot on the kind of healthcare space. There is a lot of really interesting individuals, great ideas. There's investors. Now with Jim's help and Joe Colopy's, others in this environment, we're growing this ecosystem, because the worst thing an ecosystem can do is stagnate, because then it doesn't bring value back to the ecosystem or the folks that are in it. But this ecosystem continues to grow, which is great, and it will grow and mature, it'll morph and move, but they have enough of really creative ideas. UNCW is doing some phenomenal work. The level of creativity between the industry, private, academia, government partnership, that's a big nexus that's been glacial in many years past. We're cracking it around the edges, which provides some really interesting opportunities for businesses to partner with folks that were usually outside the partnership umbrella. And then that's what really kind of grows it as well. And so that's the reciprocal kind of give back. And that's what Wilmington has. So it's small but mighty. And we like to punch above our weight, and we're actually kind of moving the needle quite a bit. You know, being voted top 100 startup environments, it's great, but it really means that that's just a little bit of recognition of what's been going on all along. And right, these four organizations here are going to be part of that fabric to continue to move the bubble forward.
Yeah, and for me, as with a lot of things, I just got lucky, right? I moved here. Before I did my startup, I moved here because I needed a change of scenery. And ended up, you know, being in the second best ecosystem in the state, second only to Raleigh. And we, you know, on our monthly meetings, people come from Raleigh to see us, so I have connections there. Getting back to the culture thing from a startup, it's pretty easy to recruit people to come live at the beach to work for your startup. So it gives a smaller company a benefit to recruiting those folks here. So as a startup, I just kind of wandered into it and got lucky, and it was one of those pounding chest moments where, hey, I made the best decision I possibly could. As an investor, I think probably 6 or 7 of the companies I'm invested in out of 12 are Wilmington-based companies, because there is just so much great stuff going on here. Some of the companies, the potential of some of the companies here over the next 5 to 10 years is unbelievable. I think we have a chance as an ecosystem to do better than Raleigh. I really do. If everything falls into place that I'm seeing, Wilmington is going to be huge on this map in North Carolina. I mean, we are. People hear us roar now, but it's going to be quite amazing when Nareem and Opiate and Predicate and all of these other companies that are just doing amazing things hit their stride. It's going to be something to watch. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, similar to Jessica, I was also introed to the Wilmington ecosystem with Jim at Blueberries. So it must be something about
blueberries. I thought it was special.
You were very special. He does like a blueberry, though.
He's only ever done breakfast there twice.
Exactly. But no, I mean, this, like everyone said, this is obviously a unique living experience. There's so many reasons to move here. Great for families. I came to Wilmington by way of Boston 4 years ago. In Boston, like, it's like medtech mecca up there, cutthroat competitive. But one of the things I really like about Wilmington is not only the strong and getting stronger ecosystem, but I enjoy the challenge of, like, what Rob said, like, fintech's already here, and we're trying to carve our way out with health tech. And what Chris said about, yeah, let's beat kind of the triangle. The opportunity exists here. And as we introduce new tech and all these advanced technologies into the ecosystem, it's going to happen. It will happen. And that's exciting to be part of that growth.
I remember, you know, about 6 years ago talking to the Tech Mountain folks about what it would take to, you know, get to the place where you're talking about. And I've watched local elected officials try to, you know, pay attention to this and help where they can. I think with all due respect, they're kind of at a loss for what they should be doing. I mean, they put some money into Live Oak Bank, which obviously was beneficial. That was a good bet to make. But a lot of it seems to have developed organically, you know, the stuff that, or that, you know, individuals have done, like Jim's efforts to, you know, convene people so you can share ideas and find a mentor and find someone who knows how to do X, Y, and Z. Or the fact that, you know, the beach doesn't suck. You know, it's pretty nice. But other than convincing David Rouser to keep giving us money to re-nourish the beach, like, what do local officials do to help this thing keep going, or should they just stay out of the way? I'm curious what you think about that public-private part of it.
I'll go. So I had a conversation with a couple of individuals around this NC Innovation Fund, $500 million in the state, backed by the legislation, to go to university-owned IP and try to spin it out. I said, that's great, but how about a side-by-side $100 million for startup companies that are not university-owned IP that want to partner with and work with universities? And then that's the blink and the smile. I absolutely think that it needs to be a shared environment, right? Risk-reward, but both on the startup side and academia. But if you only back one horse, you're going to miss the opportunity on the other side of horses. Our elected officials come from different walks of life, backgrounds, experience set. We were talking about this earlier. If I need brain surgery, I don't want to go to a plumber, right? I'd like to have the officials that are smart enough to learn and understand. And if you're not an expert in AI or other tech, then please don't pontificate. Find the right people in, because all it does is slow down. Right? Our agencies, our entities are often glacial at best. I believe truly their heart's in the right spot, but you need to bring the right team in. And if they would listen to some of the startup companies about what we need, I think it would be a very different environment. Because that's the reciprocity that we need from, right? We startups with our elected officials, and then it's not just the elected officials, it's academia, it's industry, it's banking world, because we've come from very linear, focused environments that say, this is how you get money. These are the criteria that we look at for investment versus some more creative opportunities. And I think some of these banks here in the Wilmington area, now that they've seen the growth of some of our startups, are willing to de-risk in a collective environment and share some of the money, because money is important. You know, Morris said it earlier, money is almost a commodity, but it's not a commodity. And so there are times when a startup company needs it, the valley of death everybody talks about, but you need to be very judicious in where you find that money from. And our elected officials with the finance industry and the startups can really come together and sit down and talk about what it means to share risk and then sharing the rewards as well. Because oftentimes folks just look at the money going out as a risk versus a potential payback over time that, you know, many organizations just haven't thought through. But they're willing to, I believe they're starting to think about it now.
Just real quick for folks who don't know, what is the valley of death?
The valley of death is when a startup company has a little bit of money and it gets excited and it creates a thought. They think they're solving a problem. Then they run out of money, and that's the valley, and they're starved to find a dollar to continue their development. And then if they find money, the ramp goes back up, so now you have the valley. If they're not, it goes down, and they're 8 of the 10 companies that Morris identified are no longer a going concern.
Gotcha.
That's the valley of death. It is a financial and time component to all startups, really.
And it's compressed when you're outside of the academic world, where you might file a grant application in 2024, get the approval in 2025, plan the proposal for 2026, and do something in 2027. That's a really, really long timetable.
Well, that's a perfect timetable for academia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? They want to study, want to continue the grant money. In the startup world, can't work. What we need is 30, 60, 90-day sprints. Right? That's the fail fast and fail well. And that's a different, so you're talking about cultures, it's two different cultures that are kind of bumping heads with, but we can, you can work it, right? We're doing some really amazing work with UNCW right now that's sharing the idea of a concept that could be groundbreaking, transformative, and to bring the researchers, the staff and faculty and students through this process, because their thoughts are absolutely critical as we work on a commercialization pathway that's not 3 years, it's 30, 60, 90-day sprints.
I'm curious if you guys think, is there an unsustainable size of an ecosystem where you just have too many damn startups or too many people in the space, competition for limited resource, or is that not the case?
Yeah, I think, well, there's some ratings you see different comparing different ecosystems. And example is, Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley is always top of the list, but they're so far ahead of everyone else, like their own microcosm. So is it fair to compare, the Valley to everyone else? In that environment, is it look kind of too condensed, perhaps? But there's also a lot of, money within that ecosystem. It just makes it more difficult to for other ecosystems to kind of thrive and thrive well if you're comparing it to the Valley. I think that's one example.
I would also offer, though, that larger ecosystems start to break into smaller ecosystems. So then it's a network of networks. The Valley's same way. Boston is very, very similar as well. And that's where some folks, are known as some centers around the country are known as particular either med tech or AI or other kind of verticals. Right. That's where folks go to naturally gravitate and they'll move to there to fill that. But other than that, there's a lot of opportunity across the rest of the country to find really interesting pockets of creativity and innovation. And if you match it with money and investors and opportunity, then you have something that's really, really neat.
A question I want to ask, because I've heard this for a long time, is about diversity in startups. And I hear plenty of critiques that it's, largely a white boys club, although membership in this room shows otherwise. How do you guys think about that issue? I mean, is that a valid criticism, or is it because this is a rarefied environment, whoever survives?
I mean, I can take a shot at that question. I think, again, I'm coming from a different perspective because I'm just getting started in this. But for me, I don't feel that at all. I think when we go to the events and we see what's happening at UNCW, it is very balanced. The insecurities or anything, those are on me, I feel. I haven't gotten that from anyone in the groups that I'm with. As far as seeing who gets the awards, who gets the funding, again, it seems really balanced to me, but that's from a 30,000 foot view, I would say.
Yeah, for me, I've been fortunate to where in the portfolio of the companies that I'm investing in companies that have founders that are of Latin. I have female founding companies in my portfolio. So I haven't really had any trouble finding companies of diversity. When you go to our new meetings, it's not equally balanced to where you have an equal number of the diversity. There's still a lot of white men there who are doing startups, but it is getting more diverse. And I think the pull of folks coming from Raleigh is really helping us out. And also, this is one of the things that Jim focuses on quite a bit as well, is trying to insert diversity into our opportunities and into the folks that we're consulting with to get different ideas and different takes on the challenges that we're facing and that we're talking about in our meetings.
Well, when we compare it to like a comment we made earlier about a Fortune 500 companies, and as from personal experience, Fortune 500 was not as diverse. Their leadership teams weren't as diverse as founders, startups are. And I think a lot of it has to do with the founders themselves being diverse and intentionally choosing a more diverse culture when they start their companies to have a more gender balanced team, have, you know, more more racial mix among their founding team. I think that has a lot to do with it. And thinking about, like, coming out of the universities, many of the postgrads are coming out and starting their own companies. So that kind of creates more diversity within the ecosystem as well.
I
absolutely applaud the diversity of thought. I without that, we become that groupthink model, and that's dangerous for a startup. It's dangerous for any kind of culture or society. Again, if you hijack those terms and turn it into other than the best athlete, I think that's really problematic. But without question, a more diverse, experienced team that come from different walks of life and background experience sets really provides value immediately to the company. And that's, again, I'll go back to that culture. If you look at a team that you want to build as all white males, then you're going to have an all white male perspective. And then it may not meet the requirements for the marketplace that's not all white males. So if you force yourself into that model, you're already putting yourself at a deficit. And the diversity of thought that exists in these little incubation startup innovation worlds, especially here in Wilmington, is amazing. And so if you have the intestinal fortitude to put that as part of your thesis up front, the output of that will be much better. I've seen it in startups, in big companies, seen it in the military. And I'm telling you that from my experience, you got to have the diversity of thought, because if not, you will become a single trick pony, and you're probably going to be the tail end of that valley of death we talked about a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's in my personal experience, that's always been the most compelling argument for DEI is not to have a checklist, but is to... I don't want a room full of reporters who agree with me, because then they're just co-signing all of my mistakes, you know, because I'm seeing stuff from my particular perspective. So someone who had a different upbringing, different parents, different religion, different hometown is going to say, like, what about this? What about that? It's tricky, because I think people just want, sometimes they just want to see representation instead of thinking it through to the level that you're talking about.
No, it's thoughtful. It's judicious. And it's planned to be that way. And if it's not, and I'm not saying you have to have that. What I'm saying is that provides, and then the inclusion piece is the inclusion of questioning, right? So if anybody sits there and has a board or advisors or their team, all they do is sit around a table and nod their head, you probably have the wrong team involved with you. And then that goes back to the culture of the entrepreneur. If you can't take, hey, boss, that's probably not a good idea, think about it, break it down to root cause, and then repackage it. Again, maybe this is not the right space for you to be an entrepreneur, because you have to absorb input, feedback, experience from a lot of different areas and organizations and people, and turn that around to something that delivers a very, very valuable proposition for consumers.
Oh, I want to ask about, this came up briefly before, sort of about what a company sort of owes to the public in terms of its social mission. And I know that this is sometimes seen through the lens of like a $1 trillion evaluated company that we're talking about off mics, where if you have that much money and you're not doing anything for society, it just feels like a Batman villain. But I get that doesn't scale at the same level when you're, you know, just starting from your house, for example.
Right.
But how do you think about that issue of, you know, what if in 10 years your company is where you dreamed it would be, you know, what would you imagine your social mission would be?
Right. I would imagine just tying it to my business with veterans, building houses, caring for their quality of life. And in the short term, what I see that I can give back to the community is just teaching how to win this federal work, because it is so complicated, and it takes forever to get them done. So other small businesses, they might not have the know-how or the time, the resources to be able to do these things. So if I could even, you know, conduct seminars or like, how do we win the coastal work here? That gives back to the community. In fact, it enriches communities heavily with some of these large contracts and what it affords companies.
Yeah, I think philanthropy is something everybody should do at an individual level, and certainly the company. So at Nareem, we're pre-revenue, pre-seed. We've already started our 501c3, the Nareem Foundation, because our thesis there is we want to use all human data, to include the neuro data, to improve mental well-being, healthcare outcomes. So we go into our business understanding that there's a social currency, not a financial balance sheet, but we need to give back to the community. We need to give back to the folks that got us to where we are today. And everybody has issues in their life and in their community that we all need to kind of row in the same rowboat in the right direction. Because if you, to your point, Jessica, if you don't kind of think through that model at the start, then become very insular. And it's all about you, and then that's not the true kind of collaborative, innovative environment. So folks do a good job. And it's not only kind of financial give back, right? It's time. So all of us are involved as mentoring. We all go to the university to help students. We all go to grade schools to talk about entrepreneurship, right? That's the way we give back as well. That's another philanthropic opportunity to share this pathway, this journey. And it's not a financial, but it's time, and really time for an entrepreneur is your most valuable asset you have.
Yeah, for me, I mean, almost everything we've been talking about today kind of leads to some type of philanthropy. And what I mean by that is we've been talking about the ecosystem. We're all giving back our time, our mentorship, our consulting. When it comes to Whale, the angel network off of the ecosystem, off of New, you know, it's literally probably the smallest angel network in the entire globe. Yet locally, we've invested, I think, in 19 companies. And of those 19 companies, there's diversity that we just talked about. There's female-owned. There's Spanish-owned. There's a lot of diversity. And a lot of those companies are focused on making the world a better place. You know, Opiaid is focused on making addiction treatment safer, more effective. Rob's Nareem is focused on, you know, using the power of the brain to help veterans and to help other people with the things that they're suffering with. Nala Membranes, a female-owned company, is focused on filtering water and getting stuff out of the water. So, you know, everything that we've talked about kind of winds back into giving. If it's not the mission of the company or the mission of what we do on a daily basis outside of being founders, there is outside philanthropy. And that's one of the things I look for when I am considering investing in a company. Not only what is it going to do to make the world a better place, but what are they doing outside of that to make the world a better place? And so, for example, my new startup, we've taken trips to Western North Carolina and started funds for them to try and help those poor folks out there, and started funds, and we're collecting, you know, we're collecting stuff to send out that direction. The companies that are doing this aren't doing this because it's going to help them succeed, right? Because that's not even a place where we're selling our product. We're just doing it because it just makes sense. And it just makes your company, from a cultural perspective, a better place to work.
When I started Predicate, I started with our social, thinking about our social mission first, before anything else. And core to that social mission is to promote health equity and accessibility to healthcare for everyone around the globe. And we are fortunate enough to be able to have ongoing clinical trials across 5 continents right now. And it's so working in a global scale, that's extremely important to us. Similar to what Rob said about Nareem, you know, we're seed stage, pre-revenue, but we also started a 501c3, the World Aid Through Connected Health. And we use that as, at first, the thought was to use it as a mechanism to where we can go to certain countries where they don't want to work with for-profit companies. So we have that mechanism to do it through. But we're learning that there's so many things that we could do both in our for-profit side and our nonprofit side. It's just there's a greater social responsibility that it happens to that experience. And throughout, you know, all the different hurdles that founders have to go through, I think one of the greatest joys that we get as founders is to be able to give back. And things that was previously mentioned, just mentoring others and kind of showing them where, you know, the different, you know, potholes are to go. But it's something that all founders, I think, equally share.
And I'll finish with this because I think it's important. I don't think there's anything more special than what a founder of a startup gives outside of what they're already doing. Because as we said earlier, we're all working 80 hours a day, and then we're thinking about it 24 hours a day. So to take that time to give back and to do something, I really think it's even more special than it would be coming from a Fortune 500 company or even a company that's already way into their revenues. Revenue cycling or business plan and completely out of startup mode.
Well, those are my questions. I'm very appreciative of your time today. I want to give you each an opportunity to anything else that was on your mind, or why didn't you ask this, or you know, something you think people get wrong about the industry. I'm just curious for your closing thoughts.
Thank you for having us. I think my closing thoughts are just, I'm honored to be sitting with you guys. I learned so much from just hearing the three of you talk, and I'm like, how can I get them to be my mentor? I think that's the biggest thing that I'm coming from, is just the gratitude and the gratefulness of getting to work with people like you, what Jim has done for the ecosystem, bringing me in and introducing me to everyone that he knows to help make me successful. And I definitely, that is my mission, is to give back for that.
Yeah, I would just kind of end and say, you know, this is an incredible place called Wilmington, and it's based on a lot of great people doing some amazing work, both in the business world and the startup world, the social currency piece. But the thing that is unique, and I think Moore's touched on this, it's not Boston, it's not San Francisco, it's not Chicago. So there is hyper-competitiveness, but there's even more so hyper-collaboration. So any one of us pick up the phone, if we're traveling, we find something. Hey, Morris, did you see this? I was introduced to this guy. Let me set up an introduction. That doesn't happen everywhere. So that's part of the culture of this community. It's part of being at the beach. It's part of the way Jim and Joe kind of run these ecosystems. And it's part of the individual members and organizations inside this ecosystem. You know, Wilmington's not like Savannah or Charleston or some of the other smaller kind of startups. We have our own kind of color and fabric and flavor. And that's what makes us kind of special as well. And you'll see very quickly, if folks come into the ecosystem, don't fit that fabric, they won't get as much out of the ecosystem, because if they're not collaborative, that's seen very, very quickly among the other kind of folks. And then, you know, it's a nudge and a wink to see if anybody wants to kind of help folks like that, because this is a very different model than kind of other places. So it is a great spot. It's been a lot of hard work to get here. There's a lot of hard work to go, but I feel pretty comfortable that we're on a good pathway. And there'll be a whole bunch of wins, some losses, success and failures, fail fast and fail well. But this is not a bad spot to kind of hang your hat.
Yeah, and for me, just like I've been here 3 years, and as you can tell from my answers, I'm pretty passionate about the area, and got pretty connected pretty quickly to it. So I just appreciate the opportunity to be here with a much more wider audience, and to be able to let everybody know how exciting it is to be here and how exciting it is to be part of everybody at this table and everybody in our ecosystem at New. It's just been an amazing experience, and it just keeps getting better.
Yeah, I think this is less of a closing thought, but more of a lingering thought, I guess, is I mentioned we travel the world a lot because we have studies all everywhere. Every time we return back to Wilmington, by way of Charlotte or Raleigh or Atlanta or, you know, where else, we need more international flights here. But there's a sense of pride. It's always, this is the reason why I'm proud to say our global HQ is Wilmington. And most people around the world, like, you know, either think it's Delaware or they've never heard of us before. That's our opportunity to put Wilmington on the you know, the collective map. Something else that Rob said that I want to kind of just add on to is thinking about tech culture as a talent magnet. One of the challenges is that you get people to agree that this is a great place to live and raise a family, but for tech jobs, why should they come here to work here if there's not a job for them that's sustainable, or for their spouse or something else? So that's something that we could, in the spirit of collaboration, you know, like Nareem and Opiate and Predict could work together. We're working on AI type of things. Could we co-op or share in that talent and have, you know, just engineers kind of work on similar projects so they have a more sustainable career pathway? Something that you can't do in the bigger ecosystems, but you can do here in Wilmington.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to go back to what I heard from the Tech Mountain folks, you know, 5-6 years ago, was that the critical mass that they were trying to hit was at the point where if someone came here to work for, say, Encino, and it didn't work out, that was fine. You know, they imagined a world where, like, young actors go to New York to be on Broadway, not to be in one particular show, but because that's where it's all happening. You know, so you get to the point where, okay, you know, they're doing cool stuff in Wilmington. I want to be in Wilmington, it's bigger than any one company, but like that's the place where people want to get, I feel like.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And the other cool thing is folks like you, right? Having the foresight to talk to a couple of entrepreneurs in the area, because not everybody wants to hear that story. And so thanks to you and the entire station, because it's a tough journey. There are no two journeys alike. You know, oftentimes when we go to conferences or other events, you know, somebody up there who's knocked it out of the park is the one talking. And if people are sitting there saying, that's my exact pathway, that's my route, you're guaranteed to fail, right? 100%, you're going to not make it happen, because that's a completely different journey. But having the ability to kind of, a forum like this, communicate, not only with our, you know, our partners in crime over here, but certainly, you know, to bounce ideas off from your perspective, I think goes a long, long way. So thank you for giving us an opportunity to chat.
Happy to do it. Happy to have you. Jessica, Rob, Christian, Morris, I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Appreciate yours.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks again to my guests, Jessica Kovar, Rob Cooley, Christian Pardue, and Morris Wynn, and to Jim Roberts for helping to bring them all together for this conversation. And again, you can find more about each of them and their work on our show page at whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.